Welcome to Backyard Oasis, a podcast designed by and for older adults living in the beautiful Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts and produced in the tech studios at Greenfield Community College in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Backyard Oasis reaches out to older adults who seek knowledge to help them live more thoughtfully, healthily, and happily, who hope to inspire others with their ideas, and who serve their communities in the interest of the greater good.
Good day. This is Chad, your host for today's issue of Backyard Oasis. Today, I'm doing something a little different. I'm hoping to have a series on interviews, I'm going to call it some of our friends. If we get to that, we kind of are building the airplane as we fly it. I may have a subsection, Liberation, the 60s and 70s. Interviews with some really up-tempo women in my life. Today I want to introduce Ann Burton. She grew up in New York City, stopped her career there to move to Amherst to return to the arts. She will be married 55 years next week and has two adult children and some grandchildren. Also next week, she turns 89 years old. So what I'm hoping to duplicate here today is a talk I had with Ann and her husband. They have a beautiful home in Amherst. It faces west. You can see the hills. Beautiful sky. I was invited to their home on July 4th. And UMass sponsors a fireworks. I was going to call it firecrackers. A fireworks show every year. Well, this year, of course, it didn't happen. So Ann and I had a nice conversation. As I said, I'd like to recreate it here today. She told me a little about her life, and I thought it would be interesting to most people who listen to Oasis. So this is Ann. I don't know where we'll go, but let's get going and see, is there anything you want to open with?
Well, I noticed you said friend rather than old friend.
It's not that
old
new.
Is old a bad word?
Well, we're both older. Well, I mean, we're both old, but we're not older. But Ann and I met serving the city of Amherst on something called the Council on Aging, set up by the Elder Americans Act of 64. Johnson was in office, set up the senior centers. And our role was to supervise that, to provide input. And Ann and I sort of bonded around that and the difficulties in doing that.
Not easy.
No.
Well, it's not easy doing that in this town. It's also not easy being old.
Yeah.
Not easy being old in this town.
Well, the thing is, it's extremities of age I see in this town. The very young and the very old have some discrimination.
Probably so. I just noticed coming here today, the bus stop on Amity Street nearest to University Drive. It's a hump of grass.
Yeah.
Which means that my husband, who's now using a walker, could never get on a bus there. Nobody with a wheelchair or a rollator could get on a bus there. That's just an interesting thing, that there should be a bus stop that won't allow people who are slightly or very disabled to board the bus, and those are the people that don't drive their own cars.
Right. It's actually a bare patch of ground. There is no seat, and there is no hut to get in and out of the weather.
And it's not flat.
Bus stops have coverings and seats.
And they're flat.
Yeah.
This is so, not even flat. So that was just what I noticed on the way. And every day I notice something that doesn't make life easier. And we all know that there's no such thing as growing old gracefully. There's nothing graceful about getting older. So where are the people who feel that it's important to make a town usable?
They're on every house and on every street corner, but the voices who are heard are not those same voices. They're 8 to 12 people in the town that make all the decisions.
Well, it's true. And I've run out of energy. I've chaired a couple of town committees and been on them and enjoyed doing that, but I'm winding down. And also my husband requires a lot more of my attention than
right.
he used to.
Yep. You know, if you were 30 to 50 years younger, we'd call you the sandwich generation, taking care of your daughter and parents. Well, now at the end, we call it the golden years. We're supposed to be taken care of like the babies are taken care of. And oops, there's no home health aid system in the area. You know, there's no, what could I call you, caretaker support group or anything.
Oh,
for
you
the
know.
The one who does the heavy lifting.
Chad, I want to tell you something. Having spent most of my life as a change agent in healthcare, the healthcare system has really diminished a great deal since I left it in the 1990s. But I had a shock this year. My husband stepped off a curb in front of Bank of America on the big corner, main corner of Amherst,
yeah.
North Pleasant and Amity,
yeah.
caught his toe in one of the dibbity holes that hasn't been filled at crosswalks, fell, broke his hip.
Oh, no.
The ambulance, of course, because our fire department is wonderful and the EMTs are wonderful, they arrived within moments almost as he lay in the roadway. They picked him up and brought him to the ER. He spent 26 hours in the emergency room at Cooley Dick. 26 hours without a spot of water because they didn't know whether they were going to operate or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then
wow.
they said they'd have a bed and somebody would talk to me about discharge in the morning. Well, the morning never came. He was discharged at night that evening to an extended care rehab facility.
Local.
The one closest to the hospital. I then moved him to one in Hadley. But here's the shock. If you haven't been in a hospital as an inpatient for 3 days, Medicare does not pay for rehab.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an 88-year-old husband who couldn't walk, had a broken hip. I couldn't take him home. He was in great pain.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? Rehab cost me $469 a night
wow.
because Medicare does not pay.
Gotta beat that 3 days.
And even though I have extended insurance and all, nothing covered it. Now, I have now spent $16,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And he is now home.
Yay.
Yay. And the VNA of Cooley Dick is being paid by Medicare, and
okay.
they are being wonderful, and he has wonderful PT and OT people
okay.
coming to the house. But I want to go back to that $16,000 worth of...
out of pocket.
Yeah, out of pocket. And I want to say to you, Chad, I'm one of the few fortunate people who doesn't have a mortgage on my house anymore.
Why is that?
Well, because that's... you know, that,
you paid
that's,
off over 30, 40 years.
Yeah,
that's why.
Right. So what about people who can't lay their hands on that kind of money? Mm-hmm. And what kind of country are we living in where a hospital is penalized if they keep a patient who doesn't need acute hospital care?
Yeah, they're nonprofits. Yeah.
So... well, no, they don't. Medicare and Medicaid doesn't pay a hospital. The hospital's actually penalized if they keep a patient longer than what the code says they're allowed to keep the patient. So what kind of system is this where a family, there was no way, no matter who we had in the family, that we could have taken him home the first few weeks? And so I didn't come here to talk about that, but I think it's an injustice in our society.
Yes, and I wouldn't want to interrupt you on that. As you say, though, there were two points that I did catch a little bit earlier that I did want to come back to if it was all right.
Sure.
And you mentioned serving on a couple of committees in Amherst. And moving to this town, did you say, in the 90s?
Yep, moved here in 1995.
How soon after that did you get back to the arts, as I said in your introduction? How soon did you get onto the committee? Were you on the Cultural Arts Committee or something like that?
I chaired the Public Arts Commission and was on it as a member, and also the Cultural Council.
Oh, both.
Yeah.
How many years would you say you spent on those two?
Actually, 13, almost 14 years. Wow. I was only legally allowed to spend six, but they
That's
didn't
right.
appoint somebody else, and I didn't leave until the committee had its complement of people.
Yeah, right.
So I moved here having originally prepared to be an artist. I have a bachelor's and master's in art.
I see.
But I couldn't make a living other than teaching. And my life took a lot of different turns with different opportunities. And my husband and I both disliked what we were doing for a living. But we decided to live very conservatively and save everything we could. And
while you were in the city.
While I was in the city.
I see. So inflated wage there, too, which is kind of nice.
Well, we hoped to do what we really wanted to do while we were still young enough to do it. So we quit our jobs when we were 58 and we moved to Amherst.
I want to compliment the couple. That's some heavy planning and some success as well.
How about we had nothing to do with the fact that we made a plan and the cosmic universe, God, whatever you want to call it, allowed us, permitted us to live out our plan. How many people are lucky enough to plan and plan and plan and be able to do it? And we've done it. He taught Shakespeare for nothing at the UMass Center for Renaissance Studies.
Oh, yeah.
And they've given him medals and appointed him a life scholar.
Cool.
That was because they didn't pay him a salary.
Yeah.
So he got all kinds of honors. And I had the opportunity to go back to being a maker of things. I was a potter for a while.
Let me hold you there. I want to play with time.
Yeah.
Chronology. And hear a little bit more about how you fulfilled that plan while you were in New York City. What kinds of roles and jobs and so forth did this BFA, MFA get while in the city?
Okay, so I'm going to start at the very end and then go back.
Sure.
I'm probably the only licensed art teacher that became the vice president of the State University of New York's largest campus, the Health Science Center at Brooklyn, otherwise known as Downstate.
Yeah.
It's the largest medical school on the East Coast. It has a College of Nursing, College of Health-related professions. And I was a vice president, and I earned $1,000 less than the dean of the medical school, and that's what allowed me to retire to Amherst.
Yeah. Well, you said you were the director of what?
I was vice president for university affairs of the campus. So how did I get there?
July 4th, I heard something about communications.
Well, that's how
something
I got
different.
There.
Oh, okay.
No, that's how
You're
I got
going backwards.
There.
All right.
I'm going backwards. which is sometimes a better way to go.
Sure.
So what happened was I took a job at a school of nursing in a hospital. In those days, RNs got their degrees in hospitals. And the director of the hospital, when I said, why do you need an art teacher at a school of nursing? She said, my faculty has developed a wonderful curriculum based on man as a psychosocial being throughout the life cycle. I said, that doesn't tell me why you need an art teacher. She said, well, it seems to me the faculty has left out man as a creative and spiritual being, and that's your job. My faculty is going to make these students into wonderful nurses. I want you to help them be wonderful
people.
So I wound up teaching death and dying and human sexuality, and I was director of admissions because, you know, what does the non-nurse do? But it was a very wonderful opportunity for me because I learned hospital. And one day a new CEO came and met me, and I had been doing communications and publications and things, and he offered me a job as the director of community relations and public relations for the hospital.
I'm familiar with those kind of roles. Yeah.
What he didn't tell me was the hospital hired him because it was going to go into Chapter 11. So 1199 and Ann Burton and some wonderful people that may have been sent by the governor of the state of New York all met in my office and planned the activities that saved the hospital. I'm not sure we saved it, but we got it merged, a Jewish hospital, a Catholic hospital, and a Protestant hospital. Oh, St. John's, St. Mary's, and Brooklyn Jewish all became one hospital called Interfaith. And for some reason, even though it was mostly a wonderful woman at 1199 who knew government relations and taught me how to do that, I got known as the woman who saved Brooklyn Jewish, and so I got a great job at a newly merged two hospitals in Midtown Manhattan, right where I lived. So I went from being in a burnt-out neighborhood in Brooklyn to practically home while my son was growing up. Blessed.
Are we talking the 80s or 90s?
This was, I got the job there in 1980 to 85. I happened to be the public relations spokesperson when John Lennon died, so that was my job to announce that.
Did he come through your hospital?
When he was shot, my husband was watching. There's a TV guide that says Tony Burton was in bed watching Monday Night Football when he called to his wife and said, John Lennon's been shot. Doesn't that mean that he's going to your hospital? Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, yeah. Anyway, I came out of the shower and got dressed and went to work, although TV Guide said I put on she put on her work shoes. I don't know what a public relations woman's work shoes are. In any case.
What happened that day?
Oh, dear. I got a taxi and my beeper was going off and where are you? That yeah, we can't right. get an ambulance
it's
into
down
the,
here.
Right, we can't get an ambulance into the emergency room thing. It's filled with press. Get down here. Get here. Get here. And I got there, and there were about 500 press people, and I met with the ER director, and he said, what am I allowed to tell them? And so he filled me in on how many gunshot wounds and that kind of thing, and we agreed on what the statement could be because I had a very, very tight rein on patient privacy, and I wouldn't let ER people tell the press. I mean, we were in the middle of television land.
Right, on, back then, yeah.
Right in the middle of Manhattan. And so I told him, well, given his celebrity, you can talk about the bullet wounds and talk about, you know, what you did to try to save him. But he was basically dead on arrival. So how are we going to get the 500 people out of the ambulance bay so they could continue to run an emergency room? And here I was by myself, and everybody's yelling and screaming questions. Is he alive? Da, da, da. And I got up, stood up on a folding chair and waved my hand, and everybody was still making noise. And a reporter who knew me, and I was known to be a kind of approachable and stand-up person, said, she's good people, shut up and listen to her. And it got silent for a moment, and I said, if you'll all follow me around the corner, I'll give you the director of the ER, and he'll talk directly to you, but you've got to come with me.
Smart.
And I didn't think they would. But actually, I was like the Pied Piper. I didn't dare turn around, but I walked around the corner to the big lobby, and all of those people and cameras and everything else followed me. And I got up on a little staircase, and I said, do you have a sound reading? Can you see me? Da-da-da. I'm going to get you Dr. Lin. He's the director of the emergency room, and he will tell you exactly. And they kept screaming, is John Lennon alive? Is he dead? And I said, I am not going to be the person to talk to you. You're going to hear from the doctor who attended him.
It's wrong.
And so they all, and I said, and this is St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital Center in Manhattan, and this gentleman is Dr. Stephen Lin. And he came out and he made the announcement. And then, then, Chad, I was on the phone until 5 a.m. with radio people all over the world calling me.
8 hours of
for me to tell them what had happened. And finally, somebody in Australia or New Zealand said, and what do the streets of New York look like now? And I heard myself saying, I don't know. I'm locked in the basement of a hospital. But I will tell you that I realized that Yoko Ono had a child at home.
Oh, boy.
And how are we going to get her out? Because she was going to get mobbed. And the woman who ran the emergency room, Sandra Schoen, said, let's get the blueprints of all of those corridors under the hospital. And I said, great idea. And so we got the blueprints of the corridors. We got her out through a corridor. I told a police officer, get an unmarked car to 58th Street. And we got her out. Only the worst paper in New York, the New York Post, managed to get a picture of her getting into the car. And we got her home to Sean. And the interesting thing is, guess what? A couple of years later, my son is going off to camp. Mm-hmm. And there's a little woman crying, saying goodbye to her son. It was Sean Lennon, and my son went to camp with him. And at Parents' Day, Yoko and I sat and watched the kids playing softball together.
How many years later?
Only a couple of years later.
Did maybe, she recognize you?
Maybe three. Oh, God, no. I hoped she wouldn't, and okay. Of course she didn't. There was no reason for her to recognize me. I met a lot of very famous people, Chad, but I can't tell you anything about them because their health care is their own business.
Yeah, sure.
And they weren't my friends. I just happened to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was my job.
How's it worded? Life is full of many forks in the road.
Yeah.
And you're saying take them. You took this one.
Yeah, I think it was Yogi Berra who said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. So, yeah, I became a healthcare communications person. I went into business doing healthcare communications.
You mean you ran your own company? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
I opened a healthcare communications company. I know they call it public relations, but that's not really – I wasn't a publicist as much as a lot of the American – the Greater New York Hospital Association was one of my clients.
Okay.
They wanted to recruit more people into nursing and the health professions. And so I wrote the literature and, you know, we did PSAs and
As we go backwards here, that first position, last position, first one you described, how long do you think you were there?
Oh, golly. I was at the School of Nursing for 12 years, and I was then 4 years in community relations and public relations. Then I was 5 years at St. Luke's Roosevelt and then 5 years in my own business.
Okay, that was going to be my next 5 years in that business. What about before that? I'm mixed up because we're going backwards. Yeah, it would be before. Well, you already said that.
Right. So during that time, Chad, I found a place, a pottery studio, where I could throw pots. And I want to tell you that the more pressured work was, the more sitting at that wheel, there's something meditative about it going around, the more pots I made. And I made so many pots that my husband said, we don't have a place to put all those pots. So I would go to Greenwich Village once a month, and I would set up a table, and I would sell my pottery.
Right. I cannot imagine someone in the positions you've mentioned. They sound like 80- or 90-hour-a-week jobs.
Yeah.
How you'd ever find time to do this important work
that was,
of centering yourself on a wheel.
Thank you. Centering. That's what I did. Well, it's a 24/7 job in that I had a beeper on all the time.
Yeah.
So when something happened in Manhattan, my beeper went off. Invariably, it was after I had just ordered dinner at a restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
But it was a long work week. But you know, I came from a family. My father started out as a bookkeeper, and during the time when nobody had any money,
depression.
My mother was the wage earner, and she was pregnant with me, and he had to learn from his brother-in-law how to be a butcher. So he went from being a white-collar worker to working 60 hours a week in and out of a freezer and carrying heavy beef and whatever because he had a child to support.
All right, and I'm going to stop you there. I'm sorry. Let's get back
to it. So everybody worked long hours.
Well, your mother sounds like she was what they call, it's the opposite of the trailing spouse, the main breadwinner. So I think you were in your own couple. So there's two places that you can reach back and say might have had some formation quality. Also, your dad working 60 hours a week, that was in your bones of this is how you get ahead. You work your ass off, pardon my language. So I just want to highlight some of the origins of who you are from these earlier traces. You were talking about your son. While you were working quite a few hours, you started to mention your son.
Well, I was really glad to have the job in Manhattan so I would be closer to home.
Mm-hmm.
But he always had a working mother.
Yep.
And I do want to tell you a really short clip.
Please do.
That you reminded me of. When I was vice president at Downstate, I was in the corridor one day, and somebody called my name, and I turned around, and it was a young black woman who I did not recognize. And she said, "Mrs. Burton, Mrs. Burton, don't you remember me? I'm one of your Model City's mothers." And I said, "Oh, yeah." So when I was director of admissions at that school of nursing, I set up a program where we took 10 young women who were high school dropouts because they had gotten pregnant. We got them their GEDs. We set up a tutoring program. And if anybody wants to know what makes anybody successful, it's one word, motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Resolve and motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And of the 10 young women who refer to themselves as the Model City's mothers,
mm-hmm.
nine of them graduated and became registered nurses.
Hmm.
So this was one of the ones. So
yeah.
She said, "I owe this to you." And I said, "Why?" "Because I was the director of admissions. You owe it to yourself." She said, "Oh, no, that's not why." She said, "One day you didn't have a babysitter or any care for your son, and you brought him to work with you, and you put him at the back of the lecture room with crayons and a coloring book." And she said, "You'll forgive my language, please. Don't be offended."
We got an editor.
No, this is what she said to me. "Don't be offended. But my son was the same age as yours." And I said, "If that white bitch can do this, so can I."
All right.
And I said, "So what are you doing here at Downstate, honey?" And she said, "I'm taking my master's in nursing." "Thank you." So I'm thinking, you know what? I have no idea what I was teaching that day. But the most important thing was
right.
Something that I didn't do, but it happened that way.
Mm-hmm.
She felt that if I could work and have a three-year-old and continue working, she could do that too. So sometime,
it's
Chad,
not what you say, it's what you do.
And sometime you're not aware of
sure.
You're not aware of the gift you're giving. You know, you think
if you're
doing
a whole
one
person,
thing.
If you're a whole person. Just what they were looking for you to bring to that nursing
who knew?
Program.
You don't know when you're affecting someone else. In fact, most of my visual art is about connections. It's about the single thread that connects us all.
Oh, okay.
And you do something to that thread, snag it, knot it, pull it, it's going to affect somebody else. And you don't know how. And that's a big responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Big responsibility. So you just have to try to do it right every day. That's all we can do, try to do it right.
Got to stay aware a little bit to do that. Notice.
That's tough.
Especially in stress.
That's tough.
So do stress. Your arts, be involved in arts, and you'll reduce your stress.
I don't know that it really reduces
no?
your stress.
Okay.
But it is kind of like a meditation, so maybe it does. Like the wheel was
oh, definitely.
Meditated
pottery
for
wheel,
me.
Yes.
But and it is, I learn a lot through what I make. Sometimes I don't know when I start to make something what it's going to be, and then it teaches me what it's going to be.
Hmm.
And it tells, I always learn something about myself when I sit down to make something.
Even when it's bad art?
Yeah.
You think so?
Yeah. I don't think there is bad art. I think there's non-art and there's art. And you know what? When I was a student, you did not refer to yourself as an artist. That was just the height of self-centeredness or something.
Oh, okay.
It was I'm a silversmith, or I'm a printmaker, or I'm a painter, or I'm a sculptor. It's for the critic to say I'm an artist.
All right.
But now everybody who has some pastels or watercolors refers to themselves as an artist. No, you're making a watercolor. Somebody else can say, "Oh, you made art," but well, there we are. That's
the critic.
Philosophical thing.
The critic, never down in the dirt and the dust and the production, always above the cloud, proclaiming what he sees or she sees.
Yeah, well, maybe that's one of the reasons that I thought better to make a living and make things that I don't have to worry about whether somebody likes it enough to buy it. That is a privilege. I mean, how many people can do that? Do something they love without having to worry about whether it will bring them income.
Yes, it's a trick. It's a trick.
That's the gift that the world has. Well, I don't know. Maybe I worked hard to get it, but it's still a gift.
Definitely.
It's a gift.
All right. What was Tony doing all these years that you were moving through?
When Tony and I went to college...
this is Mr. Burton.
Mr. Burton. That was in the 50s. And in the 50s, if you were a woman, you became a teacher, a nurse, or a social worker.
My mother, yeah, nurse.
But basically, you did those things until you got married.
Right.
And if you were a guy, you either went into the family business after you got your bachelor's, or you became a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer, one hoped.
My dad was headed towards the engineer, yeah.
Right. So Tony started off at Cornell in the School of Engineering and found out very quickly that he wasn't suited for that. And he became a history major. And then what do you do when you graduate with a history major? He went to law school.
You're a football coach. Oh, oops, sorry.
No, he could not have been a football coach. Maybe track and field coach, but okay. Not football. Anyway, he became a lawyer. He went to Columbia Law School.
Oh, my goodness.
And he found very soon in solo practice that he didn't like arguing cases in court, and he was much more given to the intellectual part of law. And so I'm going to tell his story in a nutshell. He wanted to meet girls, and he heard that if you taught in the Great Books program, you would meet intelligent women.
Right.
So he started teaching the Great Books, and what he taught was Shakespeare, Hamlet. And he got so interested in Hamlet, and he did so much scholarship and wrote a few papers that were accepted by Shakespeare scholars, that's really what he wanted to do. That and the fact that we were studying anthroposophy. And so, okay, but neither one of those could put bread on the table.
No.
And I was an artist who really took all those other jobs to help put bread on the table. And so the two of us said, you know what, if we live conservatively, maybe we can put away enough so we can quit before we're too old to do what we really wanted to do. That's where the plan came from. And
excellent.
So that's what we did. And we both had role models of hardworking parents, although I must say that Tony's father did not have to work physically as hard as mine, but he worked full hours and was away from home. He was a pretty well-known and highly regarded sports writer for the Journal American, Hearst newspaper in New York.
Yeah.
And in case you would like to know where the Welsh name Burton comes from.
Oh, it is Welsh, okay.
No, it isn't. It's Bergstein. But Louis Bernstein said to his editor one day, "My friend Red Smith at the Times has a byline and I don't." And his editor said, "In a William Randolph Hearst newspaper, you expect to have a Bergstein byline?"
Right.
So he called his brother, who was a physicist teaching at Notre Dame, and said, "We always said if it was inconvenient to have a Jewish name,
oh,
we'd change our names together." And so they both became Burton.
Oh,
right. Professor Burton out at Notre Dame and Lou Burton, great big trucks going across New York City. Lou Burton writes on the Olympics. Lou
Always.
Burton calls the Graziano fight and da-da-da. So the Burton name was okay, but the Bergstein name was not okay.
No.
But he had a byline within 2 weeks of changing his name. Well, there we are.
More wise in the road there.
There we are. When you come to Yogi Berra, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. And you know what? I'm going to leave you with, here we are in Amherst. Robert Frost.
Yes.
"Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I couldn't travel both and be one traveler.
Yeah, right.
Long I stood looking to one, to where it bent in the undergrowth, and then took the other just as fair, and perhaps having the, I haven't got it, the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden back. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted that I'd ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh. Somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference."
I think we're going to change the name of this one to "The Fork in the Road."
Mm. And good Yogi Berra.
Yogi.
Come to the fork.
Yogi and Robert. All right. And so ends another podcast for Backyard. This is Chad and Ann saying thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the flip side.
This concludes today's podcast. We're always looking for new ideas, so feel free to reach out to Judy Raper, Associate Dean of Community Engagement at Greenfield Community College, at 413-775-1819 if you have an idea you'd love to share. Special thanks to the creators of Backyard Oasis, Denise Schwartz, Chad Fuller, Dennis Lee, and Christine Copeland. Have a great day.